This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. For years, the NCAA has faced pressure to relax its rules on whether or not college athletes can be monetarily compensated beyond their scholarships. The organization brings in around $1 billion a year and employs some of the highest paid coaches in sports, professional or otherwise. Critics say if there's money to be made by the athletes themselves, it should be allowed under certain circumstances. Now the NCAA says it will allow players to profit off of their name, image, or likeness, with more details to come. What will this mean for college sports? We'll take your questions and comments for our live panel on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at All In Indiana. Let's welcome our guests. Joining us from WBAA in West Lafayette is professor at the Brian Lamb School of Communications at Purdue, Josh Boyd. Good afternoon, Josh.
Hi, good to be with you.
And Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Samantha Horton. Hi, Sam.
Hi, good. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Sam, what exactly did the NCAA announce a couple of weeks ago?
So they announced, the top governing board announced that they have opened the process to allow student athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness. So now the next step will be going to each of the three divisions in collegiate sports and letting them start outlining what that will look like in each of those divisions.
And to help give context to this, let's talk about how things have worked up until this point. What have the rules been around student athletes getting endorsements and making money?
Yeah, so endorsements hasn't been a thing. Student athletes have been able to work, but obviously there has to be paperwork filed. And there were waivers, and there are waivers out there for athletes who maybe have a business or something that they would have to apply to the NCAA to get approved to be able to keep their eligibility and run that business. So those are things that are out there, but endorsement-wise, that hasn't been a thing in the NCAA.
Josh, how much pressure has the NCAA gotten to change these rules in recent years, and by who?
Well, certainly student-athletes have exerted some pressure, but I think it's the actions of a few state legislatures recently that have really kind of pushed this to a point where they have to do something. And even though what they've done still isn't totally clear and they've kind of created a call for the divisions to come up with their own rules, it is certainly an action, and it does put something on the table that hadn't been there before. So I think it's kind of a combination of political pressure and the student athletes' concerns.
Have officials from the NCAA talked about making changes like this before? What's their stance been on this?
Well, they've certainly talked about it. I think, you know, because it includes athletic directors and coaches and all kinds of representatives from member institutions, things move slowly and it takes a long time to get agreement. But I think this question has been discussed for years internally. And occasionally the president of the NCAA or someone will make some vague remarks about it. But this is the first time that I'm aware of where they've gone on the record as saying, okay, we're going to change things so that athletes will be able to benefit. One of the caveats they've given and part of their justification for this change is that they believe athletes should be treated no different than non-athletes as much as possible. And so, you know, if you're a student that's not an athlete and you come up with some really cool process or something that has your face on it or a quote that you said, you know, you could sell it, be an entrepreneur, and make money. And that was a way that athletes were prohibited, as I understand it, from doing the same kind of thing. So part of their rationale is we're not really going to be paying players. We're just going to be letting them be more like a normal student when it comes to being able to benefit from name, image, likeness stuff.
Let's go back to the laws passed from state legislatures. Sam, probably the most talked about factor here, which a lot of people credit with putting this pressure on the NCAA to make this change, was the law passed in California. What did they do there?
So, yeah, California governor signed into law this very recently here in regards to letting student athletes be able to get endorsements. It's the first one to really kind of, there's several states that are looking at similar things as well, but it's the first state to really push for this. And it really is putting pressure on the NCAA, which I think is why we're seeing them now essentially starting to explore this in their own regulations and policies. But to really open a door and really start, it's in a way going to transform amateur sports from what we know, at least in the past.
Yeah, and have What about other states, though? Isn't Florida in the process of passing something as well?
Florida is also looking at it, and there's been a case out of Florida as well of a, I believe it was a football player who actually had went to court on some of this that had lost his eligibility because of a YouTube channel he had, which kind of rolls into some of this conversation in regards to social media and kind of what wasn't there 30 years ago is now there with it, with these possibilities of social media stars, so to speak, also being student athletes. And where does that line get drawn for them?
Sam, what impact would it have if states pass their own rules and the NCAA doesn't have a national standard? Why does this put pressure on the NCAA?
Yeah, great question, Matt. The big thing is a lot of schools would start becoming concerned when it comes to recruitment and having a fair playing field, so to speak, with athletes going to, if California right now they have the law, if they were to have their own law, Florida was to have their own law, then you start having athletes almost looking at what does that law in that state allow me to get out of being a college athlete there versus in Indiana or somewhere else. And so then you start having this imbalance in collegiate sports, which is what the NCAA is really trying to do. So that's really kind of the concern, and that's why the NCAA is trying to themselves take control of this.
Now, Josh, some people, including yourself, have talked about the NCAA as a business with two distinct roles. What are those roles, and how much tension is there between them?
Well, they have this sort of role as, especially now that the Olympic movement has changed some of their understanding of amateur athletics, they have this role of being the sort of arbiter of what counts as being an amateur athlete in the United States. But at the same time, as you started at the top of the show, they bring in billions of dollars. There's huge money that a lot of people that are connected to the NCAA get paid lots of money. I think something like, I don't know, more than two-thirds of the states in the United States, the top public employee by salary in the state is a sports coach at a public university. So there's big money on one hand, but on the other hand, there's this sort of very strict code of what it means to be an amateur athlete and what the violations are. And so I think there's always been a tension, especially at least since March Madness became such big business. There's been this huge tension between the NCAA as a big money-making enterprise headquartered here in Indiana, and then the NCAA as a as the final word on what counts as being an amateur athlete.
Josh, what did you think when you saw this announcement? Were you at all surprised?
I think it's inevitable, and really just the talk in legislatures about doing something like this, I think was going to prompt the NCAA to take action. But now that there is established law in California, they've got to take a step because, you know, Sam mentioned some of the potential consequences, but imagine if a student at UCLA was playing a basketball game against Purdue, and they're playing in Indiana, and so can the student's image be on things that the school's selling? Because in California, the student would be entitled to that, but in Indiana, they wouldn't. I think there get to be a lot of really complicated issues. There's been talk about some teams not being able to play in certain places if the state laws conflicted with each other. So it almost becomes like a federal interstate commerce kind of thing that the NCAA, I think, is trying to stay out of in taking some actions.
Yeah. Sam, has Indiana passed any of its own laws or even considered doing so in recent years?
Not that I'm aware of, Matt. And I think it's also to Indiana with legislature. With the NCAA being located here, I haven't seen anything that would necessarily go against or harm the NCAA. And some of that could also be just due to concern of not wanting the NCAA's headquarters to be removed from Indianapolis. And if those policies were to go into place, that could be something that, you know, could be on the minds possibly out there. So not that I know of, but at the same time, if this gets passed, it would be interesting to see. Some states are already legislators are saying they're looking at taxing the student athletes if they make this money. So I think that's something to start looking for maybe in Indiana, is if any bills get presented that would possibly in turn have student athletes pay taxes on some of this.
And Sam, one example of an interesting case that illustrates the situation is a student at Texas A&M. Can you talk about what happened there?
Yeah, so a cross-country runner at Texas A&M, His name was Ryan, and he lost his eligibility in 2017. He had a YouTube channel that he also where he talked about his time running at Texas A&M, but also had a water bottle company that he and his friends ran. And so he would talk about that water bottle company on his YouTube channel that also showed him being a Texas A&M cross country runner. And so NCAA said, you can't do that. And pulled his eligibility and pretty much made him have to decide what he wanted, if he wanted to be an A&M, Texas A&M cross-country runner, or if he wanted to not be and essentially sell his water bottles. So those are the kind of situations that I think are right out there right now. They're kind of becoming at the forefront of people's minds of, is that fair? And it kind of highlights, too, the fact that a lot of this conversation has been about endorsements. But that's really going to be for your elite athletes. That's not going to be for the rest of the thousands of college athletes out there. And so this rule change does impact the endorsements, but it also opens a door for some of these entrepreneurship opportunities, like the one that the Texas A&M runner had wanted.
And a little over a minute left. I'm trying to make sure that I understand this correctly. Would these new rules say... They would certainly help the situation with the Texas A&M athlete, but would it give that athlete everything they were wanting?
I'm not sure. I mean, that's really would come down to what each division would set as their, so to speak, guardrails or regulations with this endorsement and profiting off their name, image, likeness. I mean, that would be kind of right now that there's kind of this uncertainty of exactly what that's going to look like. So it'd be hard to answer that right now.
Yeah. And it seems like indeed they're trying to write the rules as we speak. And there are concerns about getting rid of too many rules. What kind of balance is everyone trying to strike there?
So, I mean, it's a balance of the idea is, like when I've talked to his athletic director down at University of Evansville, Mark Spencer, when I talked with him last week, it was a lot about, you know, they want to offer the same opportunities to their athletes that students get when it comes to, just like Josh had mentioned, having a business and having those opportunities that really wouldn't necessarily, you wouldn't immediately see as a conflict of interest of being an athlete and getting to run a business, but right now are considered that unless you get the waiver approved, which is another step in that process. So, I mean, it's one of those whole ideas of how do we try to give student athletes as many opportunities as they can, but at the same time, prevent it from going over, like preventing people from taking advantage of the system.
She's a reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, Samantha Horton. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Josh Boyd is a professor at the Brian Lamb School of Communication at Purdue. Josh, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
We're back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on the NCAA, I want to tell you about our last show. We end every week with the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In Indiana. Today, we're talking about rule changes announced by the NCAA to allow college athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. On the phone, we're joined by two guests. Jared Pinson is an associate professor of economics at the King's College in New York. Thanks, Jared.
Thanks for having me.
And Morgan Chall is chair of the Division I Student Athlete Advisory Committee. Thanks for joining us, Morgan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll start with you, Jared. You're a professor of economics. Can you give us a general overview of how money works in the NCAA? It seems like an incredibly unique business with so many different schools and sports within those schools bringing in varying amounts of money, to say the least.
Well, the idea here is that the main source of revenue for the NCAA is going to be sort of media revenue, TV revenue as an example. And that comes from, of course, their product, which is their athletes. And unlike what would happen, say, in professional sports, where that revenue would get divided up, you know, for sake of argument, 50-50, the revenue doesn't get divided in that fashion with college athletics, because the student cannot be directly paid by the university. So you end up with schools bringing in their revenue, and then the way that they spend it They have to spend it in a way that can't go directly to athletes. So they'll spend it on, say, accommodations in the sense of their facilities, or it'll go to coaching, or it can go to other things within the athletic department. But it won't be the same sort of split you would see in professional sports.
And this has led to this sort of bloated compensation for coaches and other associates within the organization, you know, dependent on how much TV exposure that they get. And what did you think when you saw this announcement that they've started the process to allow student athletes to profit from their names and images and likenesses?
I think it's a good sort of midway proposal in that, If you pay athletes directly, you actually open up some other legal issues, for example, with Title IX and how athletes would be paid. But this gives the student athlete the ability to get endorsement deals or to even profit off of sort of entrepreneurial activities that they might do. Maybe they're able to sell a product on the side that they're using their likeness. So it actually gives the student a source of revenue that currently they can't have, that's available to other students on campus, while at the same time protecting schools from having to pay their athletes and have to make some tough choices on what to do with the revenue stream that's being brought in. So it's not as far as I would like to go, but I think it's a pretty good step along the way.
Morgan, can you tell us what your role is as the Division I Student Athlete Advisory Committee Chair?
Yeah, so I am in charge of the Division I Student Athlete group within the NCAA rulemaking process that is essentially the voice and the vote of student athletes in any NCAA legislation. So we lead numerous initiatives related to sexual violence, mental health. We've led led the charge on time demands, cost of attendance, recruiting reform, diversity and inclusion, and now we're being the voice as these name, image, likeness rules are reformed.
And you yourself will have a role in the process when this proposal comes to your division, and can you make changes to it?
Can I personally make changes?
Well,
to it?
But can you influence any changes, or do you think that you and your people will propose any?
Yeah. So as part of my role as chair of Division I SAC for short, I also sit on the Division I Board of Directors as a voting member on that committee. And so the Division I, whatever rule changes go through the NCAA legislative process, our committee, Division I SAC, will have a committee vote in that process, and then I will have the individual student-athlete vote on behalf of the 170,000-plus Division I student-athletes that I help represent in that process. So I will have some influence in the conversation, as will all of my peers on Division I SAC. There are 32 of us representing all 32 Division I conferences.
What do you think prompted the NCAA to make this change?
What do I think prompted the NCAA to make this change? Great question.
Well, obviously, it seems like what California did kind of got the ball rolling, and mm-hmm. the NCAA felt like they needed to respond and get ahead of it.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say exactly what prompted it, but I do believe that the state and now federal legislation is pushing the NCAA to make changes very quickly. And the NCAA has been talking about needing to reform these rules, but putting it at the spotlight of every discussion in the NCAA offices and, frankly, every discussion at the dinner table across the country. I think that probably the state legislation did force the NCAA to make the decision. But to be honest, I think just the current state of student-athletes' needs these days is what has forced the NCAA to do something about it.
And Morgan, has the NCAA been transparent enough with student athlete advocates like yourself through the process so far?
Yes, I think that they have been very transparent and open to the student athlete voice. I attended the Division I Board of Directors meeting a few weeks ago, and we had a student athlete representative who attended the Board of Governors working group's recommendations when they recommended all the changes to the Board of Governors right before it was unanimously passed to approve the rule changes. And at the Board of Directors meeting, I had the opportunity to not only speak at meetings, but I also had the option to speak at a breakfast in front of all of the presidential forum, the Board of Governors, and the Board of Directors, so presidents across Divisions 1, 2, and 3, talking about the importance of including student-athletes in whatever decisions that Division 1 wants to move forward with. And they were very receptive to the changes, not only when I spoke at the breakfast, but also when I was speaking in the meeting. So I do think that moving forward, whatever Division I decides to do with name, image, likeness reform, the process, the transparency to student athletes will definitely be there, and it is there on our committee. We have members who sit on 10 different standing committees. All of those committees will be discussing this reform as well. So the process is very transparent when it comes to student athletes.
Jared, how does the NCAA spend the money that it makes?
Well, I think I want to focus more on sort of the member schools rather than the NCAA. I mean, the NCAA is, of course, doing their, you know, bureaucratic part. But the schools, the main source of their spending is going to be via sort of the coaches and, again, their facilities. That's who captures a lot of the surplus of the money, and it's simply because there's this huge demand for these products, and then the player can't get that revenue, and so that money has to go somewhere. So you end up with, I think you used the term bloated earlier. I wouldn't necessarily say bloated, but sort of a redirected way of where this money goes. So that's why you have coaches making not many, but you're making $9-10 million on the top end. In college football, which is greater than professional coaches. In fact, in most states, I think in all states, the top paid public official is a Division I coach. And so you end up with sort of this redirection of money.
And the details still need to be worked out in each division, but what impact do you think this change could have on the NCAA as a business?
Well, this particular rule, well, depending on how it's exactly defined in each division, shouldn't have all that much of an impact on how the NCAA goes about it. They're still trying to maximize revenue that they're going to get. So if, for example, the NCAA approaches CBS about a new contract for the men's basketball tournament in March, they're not going to go in front of CBS and say, well, you know, with this new rule, we need more money, because that's not going to impact that money that they would get from television contracts isn't going to funnel down to the athletes. So that's not the money that we're talking about. So I don't see how the NCAA's product would be any different, how their business model itself would be any different. Now, that's the guardrails that they put up could change that, but we don't have those guardrails, so it's kind of difficult to answer that question.
Morgan, we've talked about this a little bit, but can you explain what name and likeness reform rules actually mean, how they'll work for students?
Yeah, I will explain that, but I think it's important to also correct something that Jared had said about the revenue of Division I schools, and it's not a correction because everything he said is correct. It's just adding important information for the audience to understand that when you're talking about how much money a university is bringing in from athletics, from if I'm understanding Jared correctly, he's referring to those schools that those 29 schools in Division I out of the 350 universities that actually make money off of college athletics programs. And all of the other universities who have NCAA Division I sports are losing money by having college sports. So when it comes to the main spending, most of those universities are the revenue that is being brought in by, you know, media rights and men's basketball and football student athletes and a handful of elite student athletes is going to help support all of the rest of the sports on that campus. And in terms of your question around what name, image, likeness really is, thank you for asking that, because I think that that's an important distinction that needs to be made when talking about any reform related to name, image, likeness rules. Name, image, likeness is not pay for play. And that's what most of the country is really talking about. Pay for play is the idea of crossing that line into being a professional athlete. And essentially, it's paying athletes directly for their athletic ability. And name, image, likeness is not pay for play. Name, image, likeness is all about really the entrepreneurship and professional development opportunities. And it's not paying athletes for their athletic ability. And so one of the ways that I like to describe it too, the difference between a NCAA student athlete and a professional athlete is professional athletes are doing only their sport, you know, all the time. That's it, just their sport. And they're being paid to do that. Student athletes, those on scholarship, are being paid to play their sport and get an education. They are student athletes. They are going to school and they're playing their sport. So I think it's important to make that distinction between what name, image, likeness is and what pay for play is, because the NCAA is not talking about pay for play in their rule changes. They're talking about name, image, likeness and how to give athletes more opportunities to align them with the general student on campus.
And Morgan, how have student athletes reacted to this news? Are reactions all over the place, or does there seem to be a consensus?
Yeah, I would say that the one word I have to describe for the reactions to the Board of Governors announcement is confusion. I got a lot of, and I think part of it is how the media portrays what actually happened in the meeting a couple of weeks ago, because as we've been discussing on this call, what happened a couple of weeks ago was a necessary step for that was needed, but it's not the final step. So I received countless individual texts, phone calls from student athletes across the country asking me, what does this mean? Like, how is this going to affect me this year? Like, what does this mean for us now? And I always have to say, nothing right now. This doesn't mean anything because nothing has actually changed. What the Board of Governors did was they unanimously approved the working group's recommendations to allow all three divisions to change their rules around name, image, and likeness. And they said they have to do that by January 2021. That's when they have to propose reform around the current rules. And they gave them a specific set of criteria that they have to stay with, which is public information, which some articles linked in their writing of covering the piece, but not all articles included that set of criteria for any changes related to the current rules. And one of the criteria specifically states student athletes will not be professional athletes. They will not be paid to play their sport.
Jared, do you think these changes will protect the NCAA from some of the more common criticisms it's gotten over the years about student athletes not getting paid?
It'll protect some of that criticism. It won't protect them from it fully, in that if the size of the revenue pie continues to grow, that'll just provide sort of fuel for a lot of critics of saying, sure, you've given athletes some ability to make a new revenue stream, but not you're still not tapping into the larger revenue stream. And as was mentioned, most of these athletes are probably not going to have that many opportunities to make money off their likeness because they're in smaller sports that just don't get the attention. So we're probably talking about, for a lot of the athletes, just in the major sports. And so the criticism is still going to be there, but it does help them deflect some of it. And I think that's fair.
Jared, how do you think the NCAA would be affected if they did have to pay their athletes?
Well, they had to pay their athletes. You know, worst case scenario would be, and this is worst case scenario, would have to be probably some of the smaller sports, because most sports are not profit, don't make any profit. There's a possibility of cutting some of those sports depending on how the compensation would be. So if everybody gets a flat stipend, that's one thing. So just if everybody makes the same amount of money, you probably wouldn't have that worst case scenario. If it turns into a scenario where essentially everybody is a free agent and you can basically get paid whatever the amount you have.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it at that. I'm so sorry. Lots to talk about, but we have to end today's conversation there. Jared Pinson, Associate Professor of Economics at King's College in New York. Thank you so much today.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Morgan Chall, Chair of the Division I Student Athlete Advisory Committee. Thank you, Morgan. Up next, you may be surprised to learn how many teachers quit within the first 5 years. We'll talk to Dr. Carlotta Cooprider from the Relay Graduate School of Indiana. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Question one, how do we get more teachers? Question two, how do we keep said teachers? Question three, how do we get more diversity in teaching? Those are questions Relay Graduate School of Education thinks they have answers to, and their Indianapolis campus is led by Dr. Carlotta Cooprider, who joins us now. Hi, Dr. Cooprider.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the first question. We know there's a teacher shortage. There are a lot of reasons why that is. Can you tell us some of the biggest ones?
I think for us, what we really notice with teachers and the overall teacher shortage is that sometimes a key factor can be is that first year just really can drive teachers out, right? That first year can be so hard on teachers that they don't even believe they have a home in the profession. And one of the things we're noticing is not only is there this high percentage of teachers leaving the field, but even in that first year, it can be up to 10% that don't even make it through that first year. So we know that that first year can be super difficult and super challenging. So that's one of the things that we focus on with our residency.
I can remember being in school, and I never had a teacher that left in the middle of the school year, but I had friends that did. And it's hard on the students. It's hard on everybody. But I'm sure it's just as hard on those teachers who thought they had this career picked out.
Yeah.
And then they got into it, and it was just too much. Can you talk about other reasons why that first year drives so many teachers away?
You know, it makes me think about the deep end, right? You just get you get thrown into the deep end on day one. In some ways, teaching is the only profession that on day one, you're in charge of everything. So just being thrown into that deep end and having so many failures and so many hard days is sometimes teachers just don't feel the success that they were hoping to feel. And without proper mentoring, proper support, proper feedback, opportunities to practice and learn, they just may feel that they've chosen the wrong profession.
Say they make it through that first year, mm-hmm. big hurdle.
Yeah.
Is that experience gained in the first year enough to make enough second year teachers hang around?
Yeah, so to me, it depends, right? So depending on that first year, so in my opinion, and one of the reasons that I am so proud to be working with Relay is in that first year, if you have an opportunity to have a gradual on-ramp to teaching where you're slowly taking on additional responsibilities, whether it be classroom culture, classroom management, lesson planning, assessments, you know, all those key things that happen in the classroom. If you have an opportunity to do that in a gradual way and you get an opportunity to practice that and see it modeled by another highly effective teacher, and you get an opportunity to get feedback on the spot about what you're doing well, it was really effective, Matt, when you set expectations like this. And hey, Matt, next time, try reinforcing expectations like this. If you can get that on the spot, then you can improve your practice, much like an athlete, right? Just really building that muscle memory.
So I would imagine teaching is a lot like a lot of things. You really kind of have to do it to know what it's going to be like. And so that's why when you go into teaching, you have to sort of you have to spend some time being a student teacher. What is this? How does this program differ from that? And in what ways does it sort of expound upon the traditional ideas of teacher training?
Yes. Great question. So I went through student teaching a lot of years ago. And what I remember about it was about 10 weeks of this intense time where I was in charge of everything. And the way our program is different than that. So our program is a residency model, very similar to the medical residency piece, right? Where our teachers are coming in, they are full-time employees at the school. And while they're doing that, they're coming to class. So they're also earning their Master's of Arts in teaching. So our teachers are in the school and they're coming to class. And part of our curriculum piece is something called deliberate practice. And that's the piece where they're coming in. And this is what's different about student teaching. So they're in the building, they're in class, and they're coming in once a week for 3 hours, almost like in a workshop lab setting where we're practicing specific skills. And that's what's really unique. So you think about, again, like sports. So they come in, we have them do something called layups. And, you know, a layup is that really targeted burst of energy and practicing on a key skill. And that key skill, again, may be setting expectations. And they practice that skill. They get feedback from their partner. They get more feedback. They do it again in the moment. They get more feedback. And then they do a scrimmage where they all do it together. But the best part, and what makes our program super unique, is then from that practice session where they're building that muscle memory, they get to take that back to their classroom the very next day and incorporate it. And I think for me, it's just that real practical, experience-based approach where they're getting a chance to build that muscle memory and get feedback on it and improve their practice daily.
This is a problem that maybe someone from the outside, like myself, might see as being an issue. I would imagine part of the problem is also a waning interest in teaching among students leaving high school and entering college. Are fewer students going into teaching?
Great question. I think it would depend, you know, on what, you know, research you looked at. The materials that I read and, you know, the articles I read is that it has decreased, right? The same number of folks are not entering the teaching field as once was. And more importantly for me, not only are they not entering that field, they're not choosing that field, as we said, for lots of reasons, maybe, you know, economic equity, you know, different things. But then once they do choose the field, then they're not staying.
And that,
so that retention piece.
That brings us to the second problem, of course, the issue of keeping teachers. Would you say that that's a bigger problem with respect to the teacher shortage is the fact that so many of them leave in the first 5 years?
Yeah, retention is the biggest problem that I'm working on.
So a lot comes down on teachers, though, you know, because whether they like it or not, they're the point people. They're the most visible representatives of the school or the district and the most valuable. Is there anything in your curriculum that helps them shoulder that burden?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So our curriculum is super comprehensive as far as not only those skills that they're going to need to be a great teacher and also the cognitive background, but I think the piece, Matt, for me that's really powerful is through the relay residency, our teachers learn to build a relationship with teaching. And they get to figure out who they are as a teacher and how they're showing up as a teacher, what experiences have impacted them and influenced them. Because when you think about observation, the teaching is one of the only fields where we've been observing what great teaching looks like our whole life and maybe not so great teaching, right? So when a teacher's showing up in a classroom, they have lots of qualitative data they've collected through their own experiences.
Do you think that some teachers get hung up on, some early career teachers get hung up on whether or not they're doing it right? and perhaps not knowing that there are a lot of right ways to do it?
Oh, sure. It's that piece of, you know, maybe in the beginning, especially those early career teachers, you're going to have more failures than successes, right? And it's hard. And so then you may feel like, I'm not doing this the right way. And if you don't have a process to get feedback on your practice, to know that, hey, there is more than one way to set expectations. There's more than one way to reinforce those expectations, and there's more than one way to respond. And if you're not getting feedback on that, then you may be telling yourself a story that's not true.
So problem one, teacher shortage. Problem two, teacher retention. Let's look at the third question. How do we get more diversity in the teaching profession? 80% of teachers across the nation are white. What are some of the reasons for that disparity?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that we're really working on is making sure that our teachers in our schools that we're partnering with in Indianapolis is really reflecting our student population, right? Because we know that teachers can really relate to their students when they have shared backgrounds. And I would say that one of the things that really comes to mind for me is just thinking about the conversations that need to happen with not just, you know, at the graduate school level with us, but, you know, also at the high school level, right? Are folks encouraging individual students to make a decision to go into teaching, right? And then some of our teachers that are in teaching, especially our teachers of color, are they encouraging their colleagues? Are they encouraging their friends to choose, you know, teaching as a profession? And one of the things that we're starting to kind of find out is that that isn't always the case, right? So we know that some teachers have an experience where they're not really equipped to work across lines of difference. So they're not necessarily having those really critical conversations about identity and identity markers. And they're not having those conversations around, you know, what kind of implicit bias do I have? What kind of implicit bias does my partner teacher have? And not only how does that show up in my teaching, you know, but how does it show up in my relationships with my families and my relationships with other teachers? And so one of the things that we've heard from our teachers, and you know, we have over one of the largest graduate schools and the largest teaching residency, is that what our alums say, and it's pretty powerful numbers, you know, 90% of our alums stay in teaching. And one of the things they're saying is really just this need to have a space to talk about biases, right? And to get feedback on those biases. And because we know when we get feedback and we can apply that feedback, it can reduce the negative impact.
But that's such a hard thing to recognize within yourself. You know, that's such a tough criticism of oneself to say, I have these implicit biases. So even getting those people to the table with that that's got to be a challenge too.
Yeah, one of the things that we are excited about within Relay is we just have an amazing network around recruitment. So we actually have an arm called Teacher Pathways, and Teacher Pathways is able to recruit from a wider network than just Indiana, right? So they're typically going to historically Black colleges, Hispanic serving institutions, and they're really seeking out teachers of color that want to be a part of the Relay residency program. So we're also recruiting beyond our own state. And so when you talk about how do we find these folks or where are these folks coming from, in some cases, these folks are coming from out of state to relocate here to maybe even serve back in their own neighborhood they grew up in. Like our first resident we recruited came back to work in Indianapolis because he went to IPS.
But would you agree, though, that the teacher shortage is the main problem? We need more teachers, period.
Yes.
Is this diversity problem secondary to that, or does it demand equal attention?
Yeah, so I would say let's look at the students, right? So when we look at the students that we're serving and we look at, you know, what are their demographics, to me, that needs to be a strong consideration as well, yeah. right? So if we have a teacher shortage, absolutely, and we know we do, right? But then it's not just filling that space, right? It's not just filling that space with a teacher, but it's filling that space with a teacher that's been in a program that's prepared them to serve the community that they're in.
Yeah, but there are critics to this problem, right? That people who might say, well, if we need more teachers, who cares whether they're white or black or Hispanic? Let's just work on getting more teachers and not focus so much on diversity. What's your response to that criticism?
I would say when I talk to students, and in my experience of teaching for several years and also being a principal and other roles, when I talk to the students and I ask them a question similar to that, where I'm trying to build those relationships and get their feedback, what I learn the students have said to me is that, you know, Dr. Cooprider, it matters to me how you treat me. That's what matters to me. It matters to me how you're showing up with me. So for me, any teacher, regardless of their identity markers or what demographics they're hoping to serve or any of those things that we talk about, all teachers should be trained on culturally responsive teaching to be able to connect to the students in a really rich and meaningful way. So if you're talking about biases and you're talking about your identity markers and you're aware of those and you've gotten feedback on those and you are engaged in these rigorous conversations at your school, in your community, in my opinion, you're going to show up as a really strong growth mindset teacher that's going to impact student achievement.
Finally, in the last minute or so that we have, let's talk specifically about your program. Relay Graduate School of Education just opened their Indianapolis
yes.
campus. When was that?
That was this summer, July.
So it's really recent, brand new. You're the founding dean.
Yes.
So how does Relay Graduate School, I mean, we kind of talked about how it works to tackle some of those problems, but it's been around in some other areas across the country as well for quite some time. How has it worked in those places?
Yeah, so we have over 18 campuses, over 3,500 folks enrolled in the residency program. And I would say, you know, given the numbers, 90% of our alum is staying in teaching. We're super excited about that. Two-thirds of our Relay graduate students identify as people of color.
How does an aspiring teacher get in touch with your program?
Yeah, lots of ways for that. I mean, certainly they can, you know, go to our website, you know, Relay. But in addition to that, we are connected to all types of university. We have lots of university partnerships. So if we have seniors who are thinking about doing a residency to earn their master's, then they can definitely get connected, you know, through their college or university. We have several community partners here in the city that we're working with. And then, of course, we have our Teacher Pathways team that goes out across the nation.
Do you see this program as one that is specifically for early career teachers or would it benefit a veteran teacher?
Yeah, I love that you asked that question, both, right? And even in our cohort, we have some early career teachers and we have some veteran teachers who want to earn that master's degree. We also have some career changers who want to earn that teaching certification. And then also when you think, Matt, about a school, we also have some paraprofessionals or some instructional aides who want to take that next step in their career and they're just not really sure how. And so they can join our program, get certified, and get that Master's of Arts in Teaching.
Dr. Carlotta Cooprider, she's the founding dean of Relay Graduate School of Education. The new campus in Indianapolis just opened this summer. Dr. Cooprider, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow when we'll talk with author Robert Blamire about his biography of the late longtime senator and so-called father of Title IX, Birch Bayh. The book Birch Bayh, Making a Difference, is out now. We'll be back tomorrow at this time for that conversation. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.